Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Judicial Takings, Part 2 Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 17, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Stop the Beach Renourishment v. Florida Department of Environmental Protection. The question in this case was whether the Florida Supreme Court redefined littoral property owners' rights in such a fashion as to commit a quote-unquote judicial taking in violation of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held that the Florida Supreme Court did not take property without just compensation in violation of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments because its ruling was consistent with Florida's previously established property law. In addition, Justice Scalia, along with three other justices, maintained that if a court declares that what was once an established right of private property no longer exists, then that court has taken that property in violation of the Takings Clause. To discuss the case, we have the Pacific Legal Foundation's Director of Litigation, James S. Burling. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Burling.
Today, we're going to talk about the recent Supreme Court decision, Stop the Beach Renourishment versus Florida. In this case, Florida beachfront homeowners tried to stop a beach renourishment plan. The homeowners claim that their beaches are not eroding and that they did not want or need the sand that the state of Florida was going to dump in front of them. Their real concern is that the Florida considers the new sand to be public beach, meaning that there would be new, wide public beach between the homeowner's land and the ocean. The homeowner sued, claiming that Florida had taken their right to directly touch the water without intervening new public beach. They claimed that their beachfront property had been replaced with less valuable beach view property. And most importantly, they did not want to have the riffraff of a big public beach 75 feet wide in front of their land, basically taking away what once had previously been pretty much a private area, private beach. A sharply divided Florida Supreme Court ruled that the homeowners never had a property right to have their land directly touch the water. The homeowners appealed to the United States Supreme Court, holding that the Florida Supreme Court had taken their property with a judicial sleight of hand, creating a new definition of private property that lacked the key right to touch the water. Now, this doctrine of judicial takings that they asked the Supreme Court to take up had never been directly addressed previously by the United States Supreme Court. It had only been alluded to in a concurrence and in some other offhand references. When the Supreme Court took the case, a lot of eyebrows were raised because we had never seen a judicial taking before the Supreme Court. We know that a legislature can take property. We know that the executive branch can take property. But a court, that hadn't been seen before. But when it got to take this case, all eight U.S. Supreme Court justices who heard the case disagreed with the Florida landowners. I should mention that Justice Stevens, who owns beachfront property in Florida, did not participate. In parts 1 and 4 of the opinion, joined by all eight members, Justice Scalia held that the sudden additions of sand to the beachfront through the artificial restoration process did not, under traditional understandings of Florida law, belong to the beachfront homeowners. The court noted that this was not a case where beachfront owners lost the common law ownership of sand when that is gradually added to their land by a process called accretion. This, the court said, was much more like avulsion, that when there are sudden changes of additions or subtractions to riparian or littoral beachfront property, those additions or subtractions do not change the boundary lines of the property. So if it's gradual, the property lines move. But when it's sudden, such as with a major storm or hurricane, or in this case, artificial addition, then it doesn't change the boundary lines of the property. Therefore, what Florida did was really not particularly out of line with Florida law, and there was no judicial taking. End of story. End of story, not quite, because what followed in the case was quite interesting. It comes down to a question of whether there is such a thing as a judicial takings doctrine. In part two, four of the justices, led by Scalia, and the justices were Scalia, Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, they ruled that the court should now define what constitutes a judicial taking, although there was no such taking in this case. Scalia wrote that the takings clause is directed at government, not any particular branch of government. Therefore, it's appropriate to consider takings can occur and do occur when the judicial branch rewrites or takes away a property right. Scalia wrote, quote, "Our precedents provide no support for the proposition that takings effected by the judicial branch are entitled to special treatment, and in fact suggest the contrary." And in sum, he wrote, "The takings clause bars a state from taking private property without paying for it, no matter which branch is the instrument of the taking." Scalia then proceeded to respond to the four justices who did not join this part of the opinion, justices who had written that because there had been no change in Florida law, the court should not now address whether there could be a judicial taking. Justice Kennedy wrote for himself and Justice Sotomayor that if the Florida Supreme Court had rewritten state property law, a better challenge might be had in the Due Process Clause rather than the Takings Clause. Kennedy's main point is that if a state court unlawfully tries to define away a property right, that should be invalidated under due process, not to be a taking, which would force the state to pay for an unlawful taking. Now, Scalia's response, in part, is that the state has a choice if the U.S. Supreme Court finds there was a judicial taking. The state can rescind the underlying act, or it can pay up. Justice Breyer wrote for himself and Ginsburg that there was no need at all to get to the issue of what clause might be violated, but indicated that it would be very difficult to actually find that a judicial takings exists, and especially difficult to find an appropriate remedy and to litigate the claim in federal court. Justice Scalia, in part two, responded in turn. He said, with respect to the idea that it was premature to decide what the elements of a judicial taking are, he said that in order to find that there is no judicial taking in this case, one had to lay out the standards. Otherwise, it would devolve into an artificial question of what a judicial taking would look like if there were one, or, as Scalia put it, and I quote now, quote, "How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?" Or put another way, he said, in sum, Justice Breyer cannot decide that petitioner's claim fails without first deciding what a valid claim would consist of. But Justice Scalia saved most of his powder, however, for attacking Justice Kennedy's suggestion that due process is the appropriate remedy for cases where lower courts rewrite property law. Scalia said that the Due Process Clause cannot substitute for a more specific constitutional provision like the Takings Clause. If this statement is not read carefully, by the way, it's going to cause particular problems for property attorneys who had thought that after the Lingle decision, that property-related due process clause cases could proceed without first resorting to the takings clause, where the latter clause did not apply. Now, Lingle was a case that had held that certain challenges to land use regulations had to be brought under the due process clause, not the takings clause. So I think Lingle remains good law, and that you still can bring due process cases when property rights have been violated, but Scalia's statement here makes that a little problematic, but it's not looked at carefully enough. But look at Lingle and you'll see what I mean. But and Scalia gave another reason by stating that the liberties protected by substantive due process do not include economic liberties, and he cited with some disdain to Lochner. Now, I personally think it was quite unnecessary for Scalia to repeat this limitation of the Due Process Clause. As most of us know, this limitation came at us in a throwaway line in a footnote in the 1938 Caroline Products decision. The idea that substantive due process protects only social concerns, such as the perceived right to abortion and concerns like that, and not economic concerns, has been a tremendous bone of contention and debate for a long time, and I'm not sure that this line of Justice Scalia was necessary here. It doesn't necessarily advance the debate that's been ongoing. In any event, we now have another decision that says quite clearly that substantive due process does not apply to economic liberties, or at least four members of the court came up with that and agreed with that. Justice Scalia continues to vent his well-known hostility towards substantive due process. And he concludes with this broadside. Quote, Justice Kennedy's desire to substitute substantive due process for the takings clause suggests that what holds him back from giving the takings clause its natural meaning is not the intrusiveness of applying it to judicial action, but the definiteness of doing so. Not a concern to preserve the powers of the state's political branches, but a concern to preserve this court's discretion to say that property may be taken or not be taken, as the court's view of the circumstances may suggest. In other words, Justice Scalia is suggesting that the only reason why Justice Kennedy is latching onto the due process clause is to give the court maximum discretion to essentially rule that there is a taking or isn't a taking in the complete discretion, unfettered discretion of the court. And Justice Kennedy does not think that's wise or appropriate. Now, in part three of the opinion, also joined by three justices, Justice Scalia continues with his enumeration of the standards for a judicial taking. So the justices, again, Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Roberts, came out now with where they think that a judicial taking would lie. First of all, they said what it's not. It's not, as the respondents had argued, whether there was a, quote, fair and substantial basis, end quote, to the lower court's opinion. There should be no such deference to the lower court opinions, according to the four justices. Deference is the wrong standard. They continue that federal courts often must decide questions of state law, including state property law. And I quote, a constitutional provision that forbids the uncompensated taking of property is quite simply insusceptible of enforcement by federal courts unless they have the power to decide what property rights exist under state law. So, in other words, the court here is saying, or the four members of the court are saying that because state courts decide issues of property and federal courts also decide issues of state property law all the time, it's perfectly appropriate for the federal courts to look at and decide without too much deference to the state courts' particular questions of property law. Then the court continued, or the four justices continued, to say what also the standard was not, saying it was not what the petitioners had argued, that a judicial taking happens when there is a, quote, sudden change in state law, unpredictable in terms of relevant precedents, end quote. That's what the petitioners' landowners had argued here, but Justice Scalia dismissed that as well, saying this sudden and unpredictable test shouldn't work and doesn't work because property rights should not depend on the ability to predict their demise at the hands of state courts. So in conclusion, what do we have here? I want to leave you with 6 points. One, there was no taking of the sand here because the beach renourishment is more like an avulsion than an accretion, and the Florida Supreme Court's ruling was consistent with established Florida law. Point two, four of the justices, Scalia, Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, would establish the validity of the doctrine of judicial takings. Point three, two of the justices, Kennedy and Sotomayor, reject the concept of a judicial takings and would substitute a due process analysis instead. Point four, two justices, Breyer and Ginsburg, would not even address the question of judicial takings because it's premature. They do note, however, that there would be serious practical impediments to such a doctrine. Point five, property rights advocates are a lot further along than they were 2 years ago when it comes to the doctrine of judicial takings, but there's still a lot more to be accomplished. And point six is that we fully expect that other landowners in the nation will bring new cases claiming that state Supreme Court decisions take their property. And I would predict that a likely bet we may see such a case coming from Hawaii, where on June 9th, a sharply divided Hawaiian Supreme Court let stand a lower court decision that upheld a state law which had declared that all new gradual accretions of property belong to the state rather than to private landowners. That, of course, is exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court said had not happened in Florida. The Hawaiian case, by the way, is Manalua Bay Beach, Ohana, 28 versus State of Hawaii. With that, stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.